Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to the show, hosted by Vigabyte and brought to you this week by RSA Security. Risky Business is an itradio.com.au podcast and also appears on searchsecurity.com.au. But if you'd like to subscribe, go to itradio.com.au/security and you can subscribe via iTunes, RSS or email. Now to today's show, we've got two feature interviews in today's podcast. We'll be joined by Brett Moore of New Zealand's Insomnia Security. He's an experienced bug hunter and penetration tester, and we'll be talking to him about zero days in 2008. It seems the days of free and full disclosure are well and truly over. Bugs are big business, and Brett's going to come along and tell us why. That's coming up later. We'll also have a chat to Mark McPherson from AusCert, and I'm happy to tell you right now that Risky Business is the official podcast of AusCert's 2008 conference. We'll be bringing you hours of coverage from the event on a special AusCert page on itradio.com.au. But Mark's not coming onto the show to talk about that. He's here to discuss AusCert's executive program, which will run in May. It's a half-day event designed to bring together senior executives and managers with IT security experts, like the keynote speakers at AusCert's 2008 conference. After that, we'll be joined by RSA's Securities Jeff Noble in this week's sponsor interview. He's RSA's banking and finance specialist, and he spoke to me about two-factor authentication in the finance sector. Now, sure, it might not be the most fresh topic, but Jeff had some interesting things to say about device authentication, doing things like validating a user's agent string, looking at where they're logging in from, simple, sensible things like that. It's not a 10-minute conversation about tokens, I assure you, and it's worth a listen. But first, as always, we're joined by ZDNet Australia's editor Munir Katadia for this week's news. Munir, in what is possibly a good sign for Windows Vista, the Vista laptop being put up as a prize at CanSec West's Pwn to Own competition was actually taken down by a flash floor after the competition relaxed its rules a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. Apparently, they first of all just set everyone going, and nobody did anything for 24 hours, right? Then they had to relax the rules.
Well, they got the Mac first. I mean, the Mac went in 24 hours or something. It was a Safari bug. Big surprise, a browser bug got used in a hacking contest, you know. But he got 10 grand for it. I mean, that's a pretty good prize for a Safari bug.
It is pretty good. He gets to keep the MacBook Air too, which is not bad.
Yeah, although it's an annoying, stupid little laptop.
Hey, I wouldn't say no.
Look, if I got given one for free, yeah, I'd like it, but I'd probably put it on eBay, man. Come on. And I'm a Mac user. Jeez. You
know? But, no, I mean, the Flash law, it's not a surprise that, yes, it was Flash that was used for the Leopard. It was Safari. I mean, it's like, does this mean the OSs are actually grown up now or what?
It's just telling, I guess, that they really had to relax the rules to get someone to be able to pwn the Vista box. And whether or not that means that Vista is more secure or whether or not that means that, you know, Windows bugs are just infinitely more valuable these days and not worth wasting on a competition, I suspect it's a bit of both.
Yeah, you're totally right with that point there, actually, because, yeah, who wants to waste one when they can flog one for I don't know how many grand? Was it 10, 20, 30 grand, depending on
how
good it is?
I've got an interview with Brett Moore in the can that's coming up later on the show, so we'll be talking all about that. So in the meantime, let's just move on. This is something we've covered for the last few weeks in the podcast, which is about these poisoned search queries with cross-site scripting and whatnot. It's a really nasty attack, and it's finally picking up some publicity steam, and I guess that's because some of the sites that have been affected have included usatoday.com, target.com, abcnews.com, walmart.com, and a bunch of news.com sites. That's the same mob that owns ZDNet, where Munir here works.
It's true. Our ZDNet Asia site was apparently affected by it, and I think there was another one as well. Luckily, we were still okay.
ZDNet Asia got affected by this in a really big way, and it's really surprising to see. I mean, you'd expect your smaller sort of ad hoc websites, like, dare I say it, IT Radio, to be affected by this sort of stuff, but it is surprising that the big organizations haven't done any sanity checking on their input in their search fields. Hey?
It's true. You've got some pretty damn big names there, and they're all going down.
For listeners out there who aren't aware of this new type of attack, what's been happening is the bad guys have been going through and doing searches on websites for such wonderful items or stories as iframe source equals evil Russian script. And those websites have been very usefully caching those search results with other keywords that they've seeded in there. So Google comes through, indexes those cache search results, and sure enough, eventually someone searching for keyword X will find that page that's been indexed by Google, click through, they get iframed, they get pwned.
That was a great description. You want to, like, do this for a living.
Yeah, I should consider maybe becoming some sort of IT security journalist or something.
On the radio, even.
There you go. Now, in our final news item, it looks like a Carta site, a story coming from ZDNet UK says that a Carta site has been uncovered.
That's right. Apparently FinGen came across it. What do they call it? Excel CVV2, it was called.
Yep.
And they were just listing and flogging credit card details. And apparently these were all like gathered from people who had fallen phishing scams.
Yeah, look, it looks like a evil version of eBay, a place for people to buy and sell credit card numbers. And I suppose the interesting bit of intel to come out of this is that credit card data is going for around US$38 for a set of premium card accounts in small volumes, and it goes down for $10 for classic Visa.
Seems pretty cheap, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it really, I think what's interesting about the economics of these sort of situations is, you know, they take a risk management approach that's similar to the risk management approach used by organizations in that they've got this information, they can exploit this information. The riskier the exploitation, the more likely they're going to get caught.
Yeah.
You know, so they do a low risk exploitation, which is probably not going to yield them as much cash, but there's still money in it. So,
you know, I think the interesting thing is, though, that once these guys wrote about it, once ZDNet UK wrote about it, then, and FinGen obviously like sent a load of press releases out, they stopped listing the credit card details on this particular site. But I mean, you know, we've been familiar with quite a few of these sites. There was one in the Russia called Mozafoka or something like that. Some really
Mozafoka?
Yeah.
I like it.
They've been there. You've never heard of that. Come on, you must have heard of that one.
Oh, I'm not big into the whole carding thing, man, because they're all the same, you know?
Yeah, this is what I'm saying. I mean, it's been going for so long, and apparently this is from Ozsa a couple of years ago, and the guy was on stage and he was talking about this site, and he's saying that they actually had an official event at the Russian embassy, or rather, you know, in the Kremlin, and it was sponsored by this website.
Awesome.
Which is just crazy stuff. So, I mean, these sites have been going for a long time. They've been doing their dealings, and they're not being shut down. So I'm quite surprised that, you know, a small article here from our UK site kind of like affects it.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I don't think maybe these guys were the most seriously, you know, hardcore out there.
Yeah, probably. Away.
But then again, I mean, the Russians have always been, you know, for some reason, much more brazen. You look at something like the Russian Business Network.
Yeah.
Where it's like, yes, we are malware hosters. Okay, Moon, I think that's going to wrap it up for this week, mate. So thank you very much for taking time out.
It's a pleasure talking to you again, mate.
ZDNet Australia's Munir Katadia there with this week's news, and you can read all of those stories at zdnet.com.au. Time for some housekeeping now with a quick look at upcoming Australian Information Security Association events. And on Wednesday, the 2nd of April, that is tomorrow, if you download this podcast on the day in which it comes out, Wednesday, the 2nd of April at 12 noon at King O'Malley's in Canberra, there's a social lunch meeting. And inquiries to canberra@asa.org.au. And the next meeting in Melbourne will take place on Thursday, the 10th of April at 8 a.m. In Sydney, there's a branch meeting in Parramatta, which is on the 9th of April, yet to be confirmed, but it looks quite likely, which is going to be at New South Wales Police Headquarters, which is 1 Charles Street, Parramatta. So you want to book in advance, you know, let them know you're coming and just hope there's no warrants waiting for you when you get there. So if you've been naughty, maybe give that one a wide berth. Go to aisa.org.au for more information. Moving on now, and it's time for our first feature interview of the day. Brett Moore is the founder of Insomnia Security in New Zealand and a seasoned bug hunter. He's been credited with the discovery of a bunch of vulnerabilities. He's spoken at Black Hat and DEF CON and even been invited by Microsoft to talk at their Blue Hat Security Conference in Redmond. Now, if you don't know what it is, the annual Pwn2Own competition at the CanSec West Security Conference offers up big prize money to entrants who try to hack into several laptops running at the event. They're loaded with OS X from Mac, they're loaded with Ubuntu and Vista. Now, if they win, they get to keep the laptop and walk away with the prize money. by, you know, hacking into them. But this year, the organizers of the conference had to put up $20,000 before they got any serious interest. And that money came from Tipping Point, a company that buys zero-day bugs. In the end, the Mac OS X box was the first to go, with a bug in Safari felling it. Then the Vista box fell due to a flaw in Flash after the competition rules were relaxed somewhat. So I decided to get Brett on the line for a chat about the bug marketplace in 2008. And I started by asking him why the prize money had to be upped to such an extreme level before the competition got much interest.
Well, the number of serious bugs is dropping, and people are keeping hold of them more than they used to. The whole days of free full disclosure for everyone are over now, because people have started offering money for them just as well. I mean, people deserve to get paid for their time and effort.
This seems to be a fundamental shift in the way researchers have operated, because, you know, the standard procedure was, and the accepted ethical thing to do was, you find a bug, you report the bug to a vendor, you wait for them to release a patch, they put out their advisory, you get credit, you put out your own advisory, everybody's happy, right? But now, that's completely not the way it's working, is it? Why has that changed?
Oh, no, that's a good question. I mean, obviously, because these companies such as Tipping Point and iDefence have started offering money, you know, that's been a big part of it. Before that, everyone was pushing and saying, for example, to Microsoft, you know, why aren't you paying for this information? Why don't you pay for our time and effort? And as the industry has matured, people have realized that there is value in this information, and they can hold out and get money for it. And of course, you know, we're not talking about the dark side of it, where the, you know, there's tales of people being paid between 50 and 100K for remote exploits. If the dark side is going to pay that much, obviously the good side needs to come up with the money as well.
Well, it seems Tipping Point and iDefence have managed to construct business models that support large budgets for buying vulnerabilities. Do you think that this new sort of marketplace will force the hand of large vendors in terms of having to buy vulnerabilities? Do you foresee a day when Microsoft will buy a vulnerability from a researcher rather than see it go into the hands of iDefence or Tipping Point?
It's a good question. There's probably some sort of legal ramifications that Microsoft wouldn't want to get into the buying game, you know, be it then they start getting held hostage, you know, we want more money for these bugs. One of the things that iDefence and Tipping Point said initially was, you know, they want to create a marketplace where people can almost make a career out of this, out of being a security researcher and getting paid for it. And the amount that they're paying for some of these bugs, obviously, you know, these people are making a living off it.
Are you doing that sort of bug research yourself these days?
Yeah, it's part of what I do. I mean, obviously, in the past, I've handed over a number of security vulnerabilities to the vendors for no charge, and I guess the publicity is the bonus that you get from it. But, you know, if the money's there for these, you know, if someone wants to buy them, then why not?
So these days, if you find an O-Day, what do you do with it?
I'd offer it to a buyer first.
Yeah, someone like iDefence?
iDefence, Tipping Point, ImmunitySec.
Mm-hmm.
There's various other smaller players. I mean, one of the things that I've found, obviously the money is good, but one of the other advantages is that it takes it off my hands, and it means that I don't have to deal with the vendor.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about the disclosure. It's just done, and you get a check, and you say, thank you very much, you go get a coffee.
Yeah, I mean, having to deal with the vendors is time-consuming and a pain in the ass. You know, some of them are better than others, but they're usually, how should I put it, less than happy to be told. and it's not like, you know, when I went and talked over at with Microsoft and was talking to the teams over there, and it's like, well, you know, one of the things that you need to do is you need to make the people get more involved in the process. I mean, what you're doing now is you're saying, oh, thanks very much for the information, and that's it. You know, nobody hears from you about it for, like, until the day that it's about to be patched. And that's just, for someone who's, you know, especially younger people who have started in this, down this path, that's not what they want.
No.
They don't want to hand over this information and then just be pushed off to the side and, you know, no respect, no nothing.
They want ticker tape and a sun hat.
Well, they want something. They want, you know, some acknowledgement, and they want to be involved in the process.
Brett, one thing that strikes me as a little bit odd about all of these vulnerability sharing club type of arrangements, you know, you've got Immunity, you've got iDefense, you've got Tipping Point, you've got a whole bunch of them, is unless as a customer you're subscribed to all of those services, they don't really do you that much good, do they?
Well, that's where they get their, you know, you said, how do they have their budget to buy these vulnerabilities? Well, that's it, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, if you want to have IDS signatures for the latest ODAs that aren't released, like true ODAs, then you have to subscribe to Tipping Point and iDefense over their products.
Yeah. So really, I mean, it is kind of like a bit of a shakedown, really, when you think about it. I'm suggesting this in the gentlest possible terms, Brett.
Well, yes. I mean, you're right. I mean, I've had discussions with other people who say, well, you know, how can you do that? How can you vouch for these people that sell these vulnerabilities for money? Shouldn't they just be given over for free so that everyone can be secure and everyone feel all happy about themselves? Well, how would you rather have them? If we go back to the day where there was no full disclosure, well, there was no disclosure, and the only way that people found out about these vulnerabilities was when they were actually being exploited, and then sort of disclosure came along and this whole thing about full disclosure and everyone should just disclose all full details.
And then the vendors went, hey, people are exploiting us because of that.
Well, that's right. I mean, yeah. How do you want it? Do you want to either have it that the only people that have this information are the bad guys, or that somehow or other it gets down to the hands of the good people?
Well, for where my money is, I'd actually quite like to see the vendors buying bugs on the open marketplace. And I think, I think when we start seeing some pressure from customers who are sick of paying companies like Tipping Point, Night Defense and Immunity, because they do charge fairly steep rates.
They do, and it's variable the amount of protection that you get. I mean, if somebody sells a zero-day bug to a company, I mean, it's likely that someone else in the world knows about that vulnerability.
Yeah.
Just because of the way it is. I mean, in my history, you know, I've disclosed a couple of vulnerabilities, only to be told later on that, oh, somebody else also disclosed those vulnerabilities.
Mm.
So it's not like they're the only people that have that information. At least, you know, iDefense and Tipping Point, they do disclose it to the vendor.
Okay, well, I mean, really, until we start seeing customers getting annoyed at having to pay third parties for this sort of information, we're not going to see the vendors buying the stuff, are we?
No. I mean, why should they?
Yeah.
I mean, sorry. From their point of view, why should they?
Yeah.
I mean, there was an argument, a few years ago, and that sort of tells you, you know, how long this has been going on, and from the beginning of the industry, that what's going to push the vendors buying vulnerabilities and taking this sort of seriously is insurance. When it becomes necessary for companies to have, you know, so-called hacker insurance, I mean, the insurance companies are what push a lot of things in the world, and they're going to push the vendors that, well, you know, before we give Company X insurance to use your product, you have to be going down this path of proper vulnerability purchasing and disclosure, etc.
Brett, tales also abound of people just simply sitting on ODAs. They're not selling them, they're not disclosing them, they're not doing anything with them, they're just sort of leaving them there for a rainy day. And I think that really came from the whole Cisco ISS LIN disclosure thing. Has there been a bit of an attitude shift amongst researchers who are just more or less pissed off with vendors and don't really want to help them anymore?
Knowledge is power. If somebody has a zero day that they don't disclose, and then that does make them more powerful. One sort of on that same line, I found it interesting that this whole, you know, pwn to own competition, and that it's going to get even more interesting next year when, you know, so somebody discovers a nice juicy vulnerability in the next 6 months. Why disclose it? Why not hold out until next year's pwn to own? Maybe the ante will be 30,000.
Yeah, but maybe someone else will have got there first.
Well, that's the risk, right? Maybe you go to the competition and the guy in line in front of you has it.
Insomnia Security's Brett Moore there. Next up, we're chatting with Mark McPherson from OSCERT. This year, OSCERT is running an executive program at its conference. It's hoped the group could get some seriously high-profile executives to attend a special $250 half-day session all about e-security. But is the boardroom actually ready for this sort of information or this sort of event? I started by asking Mark what sort of speakers the executive program attendees will have access to.
As you see on the program, we've got several senior executive style speakers. One in particular is actually a CSO, John Stewart from Cisco Systems, and there's Brian Snow, who's used to talking to very high-level government organisations.
Well, he's ex-NSA, isn't he? He vanishes under a cloud of mystery when he goes to the bathroom. He's quite amazing.
That's right. He's quite interesting from a secret squirrel sort of background. And then David Rice, who's an interesting chap who brings very much the economic view to the table marries that with how technology affects economics. So we've got three fairly different sort of perspectives from the speakers on the program, which will hopefully provide a very broad cut across a lot of the issues.
One thing that I've noticed is every year, we always hear people saying, you know, this year, finally, we'll get taken seriously in the boardroom. You know, it's like security professionals have always been the loudest tree falling in the woods with no one there to hear them, you know. And it's almost like this wishful thinking thing, which is, you know what, next year the boardroom's going to call me in to give them a presentation and they're really going to start taking this seriously. It hasn't happened yet. I mean, let's be frank, it has not happened yet.
No. We haven't seen a lot of evidence of that, I agree, and certainly I see late to mid last year they were still talking about how IT security or InfoSec security has earned its place in the boardroom.
But, but it's yet to actually...
actual evidence of it sitting at the table.
It's earned its place in the boardroom, but the seat is yet to be installed. Is that sort of the idea?
It's stuck in paperwork. I think maybe it's a possibility that with a lot of IT security in the past, it's often had to have some sort of disaster before people take notice and take action.
Fire alarms
in the building. You know, are they working? Oh, goodness, we had a fire. Somebody got hurt. Oh, we probably better upgrade that alarm system. You know, it's this that kind of syndrome, unfortunately, that might be happening.
Funny you say that, because I actually wrote a similar thing in a piece for searchsecurity.com.au a couple of weeks ago, which was really talking about these data breach disclosure laws. Someone had plotted on a timeline the 10 biggest data breaches since 2000. And they sort of incorrectly inferred from the graph that the problem was getting more serious as we got towards where we are now, because the breaches were more and more, were closer together. But really the reason they were closer together is because now in the United States, something like 41 US states have mandatory disclosure of data loss incidents, and we're about to get that here. So do you think we're going to see a big one here, sort of like the Hannaford Stores thing, and that's really going to scare the absolute willies out of the larger corps?
It's difficult to say. I mean, InfoSec has always been a bit of a question mark as far as how it's considered at the boardroom level. Is it a competitive advantage? Is it really just simply about business continuity? These kinds of things are the questions they ask themselves at the boardroom level. So I'm not really sure whether it's going to be a big impact or not.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, it would really depend on what the impact of such a data loss incident would be, wouldn't it? I mean, if the data loss incident hit the front page, caused the company's share price to dip by 5%, and then it was all forgotten about in a couple of weeks, it wouldn't really give people the incentive to do much.
That's right. But if it caused a big company to fall over, then that would cause quite a ripple, and the industry might change there.
So it could just affect certain verticals, couldn't it? Like processing houses and you know, people in finance and things like that, would you expect?
Yeah. Well, finance is a good example. I mean, right now, you know, for example, online fraud is costing quite a lot of money, and the banks are still very much sort of wearing the brunt of it, you know, riding out the storm. And it'll be interesting to see when, if ever, that changes.
Well, you know, when we talk of security as a business enabler and as a competitive edge, I mean, we've got things already in Australia like two-factor authentication in the case of banking. So Commonwealth Bank has SMS-based authentication as a differentiator from the next guy who uses tokens. Do you think we're going to be seeing more of those sort of strategic projects aimed at delivering some sort of marketing or competitive edge?
Yes, I hope. I think we will, because as people start to realise the impact of online fraud and the, you know, experience it themselves, people will be looking around for more assurance or insurance, if the right word, and they'll be looking for people with facilities that provide that additional level of comfort. So I mean, I know as a consumer myself, I'd like to take up a financial institution's offer of multi-factor authentication. The more, the better. It just makes some more sense to me.
You want to give them a secret handshake, don't you? I know you, Mark.
I just want to have that level of assurance that my transactions are being handled as secure as possible. So,
Mark McPherson, thank you very much for speaking to us on Risky Business today.
My pleasure, Patrick.
Mark McPherson there from AusCert. So if you'd like to educate your higher-ups about why what you do is important, you might want to consider sending them to AusCert's half-day executive program on the Gold Coast. Head to auscert.org.au for more information. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview. RSA Security is paying our bills this week, God bless them. So in this week's sponsor interview, we're chatting to the company's banking and finance specialist, Jeff Noble, and we're discussing two-factor authentication. Now that token and SMS-based authentication solutions have been rolled out, Jeff says plain old two-factor authentication is looking a little bit dull.
Oh, certainly banks and financial institutions, and interestingly more and more non-banks, are recognising that they need to strengthen authentication. But with the maturation of two-factor authentication tokens and SMSs being the first line of choice, people are looking for second and third line. So there is a lot of interesting stuff out there, a lot of it aspirational, and a lot of it things that can be done behind the scenes to give both the consumer and the bank the confidence they want that these almost customer not present transactions are safe.
Yeah, well, that's one interesting aspect, I think, to this whole 2FA debate is that we haven't really seen many voice authentication projects get up from security teams. It seems to be something that is pushed more heavily from the call center sort of area. Have you noticed that as well?
Oh, certainly voice recognition in the call center is where it's going to start. I mean, the challenge, I guess, with voice recognition is the registration phase and also the size of the files that people need to gather. I think as the call center becomes more reliant on IP and, you know, obviously web banking is heavily reliant on IP, we're seeing more and more banks consider what the mobile phone does for banking, whether it be text banking or WAP or just browser to phone or even applets, then the constant will be IP. And if we can utilise what they're investigating in the call centre, it'll just pop up automatically in the other channels.
Well, okay, but I got to say, Jeff, this is one thing that really annoys me, okay, is you've got at the moment this great system for internet banking with banks like Commonwealth, right? So what you do is you enter in all the amount you want to transact with and they send you a one-time password to your mobile phone, which is an out-of-band one-time password. You plug it into a form and bang, off you go, right? Pretty hard to meddle with that sort of transaction. Now, what really is driving me to distraction is that the banks are really looking at mobile banking applications and how to roll them out to handsets, mm-hmm. which really removes the handset from being an out-of-band device. All of a sudden, it's in-band.
Absolutely.
And we're going right back to square one with mobile banking. We've learned absolutely nothing from the whole experience.
Yep.
I mean, are these guys sitting around, you know, licking lead paint, or what's the go? I know they're your customers.
I think on the Commonwealth Bank one, you could almost go a step back further, and even though the delivery mechanism is out of band, the execution of that one-time password is back in the band. So even though you're tapping away at your keyboard, transferring funds for purchases or utilities, your phone goes beep beep, you get a code. And then you just put that code back into that band anyway. I mean, it doesn't remove the possibility for the man in the middle and Trojan attacks, which are actually more prevalent than phishing now. So there's that. But back to your original line of questioning, I mean, the instance of all of a sudden I'm back in band because the SMS is in the channel that I'm banking on brings it back to more transparent, but what most would argue equally secure ways of identifying the user and the transaction. So if once you get a picture of the user's behavior and the user's typical device, then you can crank down your risk score yourselves. I mean, if I'm doing online banking from work, it'll be an IP address for RSA out of Boston. At home, it'll be a Telstra IP address, and I'll be out of Lane Cove.
What's the IP, Jeff?
There's a dot in there somewhere.
Yeah, okay, right.
Likewise, my phone. There's lots of not just the IMEI characteristics, but who my carrier is, what time of day it is, what type of transaction it is. So device ID is kind of the extra, you know, it's one and a half, if not two factors. So I know I'm G Noble and I know my password is Go Swans. That's a joke. not that it's not only that it's my password, but that I would even consider supporting the Swans is both a joke.
Okay, good. Thank God for that.
So there's that. And the second thing is that just analytics within the application that I'm in. It's snooping around going, well, this looks like Jeff's PC. It's got an Internet Explorer browser, not Firefox. It's version X. It's got cookies abled or disabled. He's got this antivirus in it. He uses UK English, not American English or French or Estonian. He's paying away to a standard.
Look, I get where you're going, right? This makes a lot of sense, is to actually profile, you know, I mean, you do get a lot of information, whether or not it's from your browser agent string or, you know, maybe an OS fingerprint, if that's possible.
Yeah,
really, to do
yeah.
that passively, I don't really know. I mean, you guys are the experts in that. But yeah, that absolutely makes sense. But it also gets annoying for me when I go overseas and I go to pay my rent and it says, you're not him. He doesn't live in Germany.
Mm.
We've locked you out. And then all of a sudden I have to ring my bank from Germany.
Yeah.
Payphone in Dresden.
Which is absolutely one end of the scale. The other end of the scale is you don't look at all and care where he is and what his devices are. And right in the middle is the sweet spot of I, as the bank, have enough reason to be called upon to make a decision at this point in time. My decision might be pay away but defer. It might be interrupt the session for maybe some further engagement with Pat. Say, we're going to send you an SMS, you're going to answer your mother's maiden name type questions, give us your password again, whatever it is. Or exactly where you stated, just stop payment. But there's decisions to be made based on risk.
Who is it, Jeff? I've got to ask too. Who is it that who decided that the answer to the question, what is your mother's maiden name, is the absolutely most robust thing you can ask someone as an authenticator?
That's a perfect vehicle for multi-channel fraud there, because mother's maiden name is your key to getting somebody in the call center to unlock your web banking for you. But I think the banks have recognised that, you know, tax file numbers, mother's maiden names, date of births are now gone. Typically, the questions need to be well thought out questions and life questions that you tend not to forget but aren't transient. So what is your favourite food might well have a very, very different answer before and after your trip to India.
You can't have a favourite food.
Exactly.
You can't.
Exactly, but you can.
You can
remember the street that you grew up in.
Yes.
And you can remember...
Unless you were a gypsy.
The gypsy online banking segment.
That's right. Well, you know, it's going mobile, Jeff.
The online marketeers are after them.
That's right.
And they're doubloons.
It's a burgeoning niche.
They're silver doubloons.
They are very heavy mobile users. Mm. Now, look, the other question I was going to ask, and this actually ties in, it is relevant. One thing that absolutely stuns me is when the banks, when I always forget to notify my bank that I'm going overseas and they wind up suspending my account, what I really don't understand is why they can't actually look into my other accounts held by the same financial institution, see that I made a withdrawal or a purchase at Sydney Airport, see that I've then made a withdrawal or purchase, you know, from an ATM using my PIN, you know, card present transaction, totally authenticated, and then I go to pay my rent over an internet transaction and they cut me off. How long do you think it's going to be before we start seeing more intelligent BI, you know, business intelligence sort of systems that will mesh into the fraud detection stuff? I mean,
it's happening as we speak.
Yeah.
And to the channels where RSA is traditionally helping the banks, we're seeing things exactly like that. So, okay, so Pat's used his card in an ATM, proven non-fraudulent in Dresden. Now he's trying to make a mobile phone banking payment, but he's being transferred to his Telstra via Deutsche Telekom, and he's also coming in from an IP address owned by XYZ ISP in Germany, and all of these things become part of the profiling so that your multiple devices are recognised. One of them needs to trigger first as a non-fraudulent transaction, and they would make decisions such as ATM, chip and PIN proven non-fraudulent as opposed to card/customer-not-present transaction. So it's coming. It's business intelligence, and it's also just about device ID, because the only constant in all of these not in branch banking is that you've got an identity. You need to get some assurance about that identity, and all those other things will build up the level of assurance about it. So I think it's coming.
Sure. I mean, one thing that just really strikes me, you know, after having had this conversation, is that it's going to be required on the bad guys' side of the fence once they've actually got some credentials, or they can. I mean, they're really going to have to just man in the middle transactions, aren't they? I mean, forget about the days of harvesting usernames and passwords and then using some throwaway box they've pwned in Botswana to do the transfers.
Mm-hmm.
It's all going to go real time man in the middle, isn't it?
Oh, and it's happening as we speak.
Yeah.
The first stage was man in the middle, then universal man in the middle kits, and now man in the browser type sessions, as I outlined before, where I'm paying you $400 for the KISS LP I bought off you on eBay, which is sad that that's actually true. but it looks to me, and I'm authorizing a $400 payment to P. Gray at, but in the background, somebody's using my authentication to approve that to go and pay away $1,489 to Bad Guy X.
Yeah.
Now, once it's still electronic money, and they need to get people to cash out. So the success of harvesting people's username and passwords in traditional phishing scams still goes on, but their return is reduced by the amount of people that are accepting that as a valid bank question.
Yeah.
But at the other end, still mums and dads of Australia are also subject to the registering their interest in being the financial arm of a multinational company and help transferring funds out of online banking.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's still, you know, people are still required in the system to get the cash out of the system. So
yeah.
The education, I mean, maybe we come full circle and maybe tokens everywhere aren't, you know, be it SMS or hardware tokens everywhere, aren't really giving the full security wrap that they might have once done. But they're just sending overt message to everyone that you need to be aware.
It's that whole arms race thing, isn't it? Jeff Noble, thank you very much for your time and insight this week.
Patrick, as always, it's been fun.
RSA Security's Jeff Noble there with this week's sponsor interview. And a big thank you to RSA Security for paying our bills this week. And that's it for this edition of Risky Business. This week's Sound Foundation track is called In a New Light, and it's by Four. You can buy it from soundfoundation.com.au for $1.30. And until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. I'll be rolling. I believe I'll make my own.